Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org or on Facebook and Twitter and at the club's YouTube channel. I'm Fred Blackwell. I'm the CEO of the San Francisco Foundation and the chair for today's program. It's a pleasure to be here. My role is to kick things off, and I'm going to keep my remarks brief because I know there's a lot of interest in hearing from the folks up here because this presentation actually sold out faster than a Beyonce concert. This program is sponsored by the Bay Area Leads Fund of the Foundation, and the fund was put together at the Foundation to expand the impact in the region of the Foundation and strategically use our leadership and our partnerships to advance equity in an inclusive Bay Area. The program is part of the San Francisco Foundation's kind of series focused in on people, place, and power as avenues to strengthen and support equity and inclusion in the Bay Area. And so we are very happy to be here and want to thank our donors for the opportunity. Today's program, entitled Changemakers, Movement Leaders on Civil Rights in an Uncivil Time. That really puts it perfectly, doesn't it? Really at the right time. We are in a climate where the issues are important, the stakes are high, and the discourse, I would say, has been funky. We're in a climate where division, hatred, and fear have been used to advance policy, advance agendas, drive the public discourse. And the question that we're exploring tonight is, what do movement leaders do in a time like that to build power, strengthen voice, and advance an agenda that includes everyone? And so it is my pleasure at this point to introduce the panel. And as I said, we will get right to it. First, to my left, is Larisa Duganqueta, who is the executive director of CRESCEN San Francisco, where she continues to build on the organization's 30-year history of responding to the needs of the Central American diaspora and the greater Latino community in the San Francisco Bay Area. CRESCEN's three core areas of focus are advocacy for immigrant rights, juvenile justice, and Latino health, and the transnational vision for Latinos to thrive in the United States. Prior to joining CRESCEN in 2012, Larisa worked for the San Francisco Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. We actually worked together then, and at KQED, where she developed initiatives focused in on media literacy and Latino outreach. Next to Larisa is Rashad Robinson, who is the executive director of Color of Change, the nation's largest online racial justice organization. Driven by over 1 million members, Color of Change campaigns have won justice for black people hurt or killed by anti-black violence, prevented attempts to suppress the black vote, and forced news and entertainment outlets to represent black people accurately and fairly. Under Rashad's leadership, Color of Change continues to advance the well-being of black workers, students, families, farmers, immigrants, and others. Prior to his work at Color of Change, Rashad served as Senior Director of Media Programs at GLAAD, where he led the organization's programmatic and advocacy work to transform the representation of LGBT people in news and entertainment media. Next to Rashad is Abdi Saltani. He has served as Executive Director of the ACLU of Northern California since 2009. Focused primarily on the overall strategy and direction of the organization, he served on the executive committee of Proposition 47 ballot measure campaign, which sought to replace the death penalty in 2012. He helped to convene the Blue Ribbon Commission on Marijuana Policy with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, and is currently leading a project to examine campaign finance policy. Before coming to ACLU, Abdi served as a community organizer and led a number of policy campaigns in California. Next to Abdi is Tom Steyer. He's a business leader and a philanthropist who said, "We all have a moral responsibility to give back and help ensure that every family shares the benefits of economic opportunity, education, and a healthy climate. In 2010, Tom and his wife, Kat Taylor, pledged to contribute most of their wealth to charitable causes in their lifetimes. Tom has led campaigns to invest money in California schools, fight climate change, and now serves as president of NextGen Climate, an organization he founded in 2013 to prevent climate disaster and promote prosperity for all Americans. Finally, our moderator, Mina Kim, is from KQED News, anchor and the Friday host of Forum. Mina started her career in public radio as an intern at KQED before becoming general assignment reporter and then health reporter for the California Report. Her work has been recognized by the Radio Television Digital News Association, the Society of Professional Journalists, and Asian American Journalists Association. And at this point, please welcome our panelists as I turn it over to Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Blackwell. It's really an honor to be moderating this sold-out program tonight. And I think the fact that it's well-attended is really a testament to the caliber and experience of the panelists that you see before you tonight, but also to a real hunger, I think, for movement building right now. We saw this over the weekend with the protests that sprung up at airports across the country in response to President Trump's immigration orders. We saw it in the Women's March right after the inauguration, the sister marches across the country and also even across the world where you saw millions coming together to resist. And so inevitably what happens when there's this big showing of resistance is the question, how do you channel all of that energy into creating lasting change? And that's what these panelists are here to tell you tonight. And just as a foundational question to kind of help understand where our panelists are coming from, I'd like to ask each of them to talk about what they feel like is at stake right now, how they define it in terms of for their communities, for themselves, for the issues that they care about. As Fred Blackwell said in the introduction, the stakes are high and this is an uncivil time. So Larissa Dugan Cuadra, could you start by just telling us, how do you define what's at stake right now for the community you serve?
Yeah, I think in general there's so much at stake. We've just been bombarded in the last 2 weeks and then the 2 years leading to the election of our current president. From the migrant community's perspective, what's at stake is the fear that our families are feeling in terms of the real risk of separation. We've seen that already happen literally over this weekend where people who even have permanent residency have been detained at airports. And we obviously stand in deep solidarity with the Muslim and Arab communities in the United States. And we are pained by how this community is being targeted and how the general 11 million migrant community in the United States is being targeted. We are a nation made of immigrants. I am the daughter of an immigrant. I am married to an immigrant. And I can tell you that the day that Donald Trump won, when we woke up that morning, the first thing my son asked me was, is Happy going to be okay? That's my husband. Is he in danger? What's going to happen to ex-friend? What's going to happen? You know, we're obviously migrant community, so we're mixed status families. And there was a long list of people that my son was immediately worried about. And I think that's true for everyone in our community. There's a lot of questions and fear, and I think there's also, there's a silver lining in everything, so we're also prepared, we're strong, we're resilient. The migrant community is resilient, is strong, and we've been in this journey for a long time, but this man in 2 weeks has basically managed to fast forward everything to a point of just creating a bit of chaos. But yeah, what's at stake again is family separation, children being afraid and parents being afraid to send their kids to school, people afraid to go to work. Just last week, ICE agents showed up to a nonprofit organization in the Mission District. There was no raid, but just their presence alone was enough to instill a profound sense of fear. And I guess we'll get into more of the other other issues, but I think for us that's really the biggest concern is that families are, that people will be picked up through sweeps and that families will be separated.
Rashad Robinson, what about you?
So Barack Obama ran as a change candidate, and Donald Trump ran as a change the rules candidate. And that archetype is much more dangerous. And so beyond the sort of set of issues that I could list off that are either in the news right now that are under attack or will be over the course of the next several weeks, what's really under attack is the rules by which we understand government and our society to operate. And then that actually makes it much harder for us to understand what the ways in which we move ourselves forward, because the old rules no longer apply. Will judicial rulings actually be implemented? Will laws that the government doesn't agree with be enforced? That type of change the rules mentality means that the levers of legal or policy don't apply the same way. And if we're not thinking about what it takes to build strong, powerful, people-centered movements while also working to change narrative and change culture and change the way we get and receive and move on information, then we're not actually going to move. Like, we can't simply legal ourselves out of it, although that's important. We can't nonprofit executive direct ourselves out of it, and that's important. But those things, those tools alone don't actually give us the ability to build the type of movement that's going to take this country back. And so what's at stake for us are all the structures by which our society works. We may not have agreed with the housing and urban development secretary and prior administrations, but we knew they knew something about housing and urban development. And, you know, my lemonade stand in elementary school now allows me to be commerce secretary. And that changing of the rules, that changing of the structures is incredibly dangerous for the future of our democracy. But as people who want to advocate and make change, and as coming from a people who are not immigrants, but whose struggles and whose progress has been at the heart of social change that has made it possible for so many others to also see themselves as full citizens in this country and experiencing the full progress that this country can provide, the rules along the way have provided a roadmap, not just for Black folks, but for other communities that have leveraged that playbook, have stepped into that legal framework. And all of that is at stake, which means America right now is at stake.
Rashad, can I just ask you as a quick follow-up? When you talk about the rules and you've cited our structures, right? Are you also talking about the norms with which we engage with each other, especially across differences?
Well, I think that that's been under attack for a little while now. I think that all the beauty of aspects of the participation age that technology provides has also had some setbacks in the fact that we are not getting the same information at the same time, that we are much more siloed, that the advance, that the sort of progress of neoliberalism on our society, whether it's in schools where the height of school integration was 1980 in this country, and since then it's gone down, and so people actually are not around each other in schools, in their churches, in their communities, and as a result, the norms, some of those norms have been breaking down for a while. The fact of the matter is, though, that what we've, the authoritarian regime that's now in charge will be able to leverage all of that sort of societal breakdown and create a new order if we don't actually recognize that the way out is not the way that we got here.
Abdi Soltani, same question to you as the head of the Northern California chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. What is at stake right now in your view?
So there's a great deal at stake. And first of all, it's a lot of people's lives. Since Friday, when the executive order on the Muslim ban for the 7 countries that were affected was issued, my telephone text messages email are just flying off. I'm Iranian American. I know a lot of people in the Iranian American community. And the number of people who've been contacting me in a full spectrum of situations is truly unfathomable. And how quickly it came about, how little process there was, and it was just not even done like a proper executive order even. So there are people who contacted me who, my age, they've had a baby born here in the United States. The grandparents of this baby are coming to meet the grandchild from Iran to spend time and to support their children and to bond with the grandchild. And they are en route in an airport in Vienna and not allowed to board a flight. All the way to people who've lived in this country for many years, they're on visas. Their visas are about to expire in 2 weeks, and they know that under the current order, they will not have a renewal of that visa most likely in just 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so the issues of immigration, which affect so many people in so many different points in our lives and different status, are landing in the community that I know best, the Iranian American community. And this is just one of the very first salvos of what the next 4 years are going to be like. But to the question of what's at stake, there's something deeper at stake. And this picks up on what Rashad talked about, which is, what are the fundamental ideas that this country was based on? But deeper even than that, what was the struggle that went in to those ideas becoming what they are? So the First Amendment of the United States Constitution guarantees us the freedom of religion, and that the government shall not establish a church or give preference to one religion over another. Do we think about how much struggle went into forming that view? The centuries in which one religion oppressed the other. Name a religion that was not once oppressed by the power of the state when it was in the hand of another religion. We cannot find one. A lot went into the First Amendment. Then we go through the struggle of slavery. We go through the struggle of the Civil War. We go through the second founding of the United States, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. The 14th Amendment I hold very dear. It's the principle of equal protection under the law, and it specifically says for persons, which means citizen and non-citizen alike. What went into securing the 14th Amendment, and how is it immediately under assault just 2 weeks into this administration? These are weighty things. People fought for these things, and we're not going to let them go. Not here, not now, and not under our watch.
Tom Steyer, Fred Blackwell call this an uncivil time. It's the title of this program tonight. How do you define where we are and what's at stake?
So I think that what the other panelists are talking about are the very broad-based attack on fundamental American rights that we have fought for not just years or generations, but centuries. So we're talking about the fundamental rights, and you can see this administration lining up to go after the absolute basics, you know, the right to vote. You can see them lining up to try and increase voter suppression, a free press. You can see them going after the right of a press to get information. The belief from the Reformation that there's such a thing as scientific fact, and that we are going to base our analysis and our decisions on truth-telling, not that we're not going to have a political person have to vet every scientific release. Religion, immigration, you know, this idea today that the president said, unless you do what I want on the in terms of the Supreme Court, we're going to take away, we're going to do the so-called nuclear option and get rid of the filibuster. So when you think about where, you know, Abdi was talking about where we started at the beginning of the Republic and where we've come. And we've come a long way. If you think there has been a fight for hundreds of years to accept people as full human beings in the United States. Mm-hmm. Most of the people in this room would not have been considered citizens at the founding of the Republic. Right. And the fact that people have been able to progress the way we have, we're far from perfect. But that progress is actually the success of America. Right up to marriage equality. And the idea that we would go back on any part of that is so offensive that it's right at the heart of civil society. But I want to take two more steps. I want to take three more steps. One is, the other thing that is threatened here is very much the relationship between the states and the federal government. And as Californians, we should know this. The president is saying specifically about sanctuary cities, but he's saying it about healthcare. He's saying about, if you don't do what I want, I will punish you. I will not treat you like American citizens. I will not treat you like an American state. I will not treat you like Americans. I will punish you until you do what I want, whether you have an obligation to do it or not. I view that as a shocking fact. And I think he has that same attitude, and you can see it in how he treats foreign countries and our traditional allies. When, you know, I was personally appalled to watch the way he treated Mexico. Here we have a neighboring country. We share a long border, but we share so much more with Mexico. And the idea, the insulting way that he treated the president of Mexico, the idea of how much we dislike you, how much we disdain you, we will force you to do what we want, we will not treat you with any respect. I just felt terrible about that in terms of what it said about how we view ourselves relative to all the other people in the world. I think that's a huge threat because it's one of those things I always say, if you think, I have two brothers, if you think I could walk into my bedroom when I was 12 and punch my brother in the face and go like, now we're even so we can move on. That's not how human beings are. One last point, which is this. Look at this panel. Look at the people sitting in this room. That's a triumph of America. So we have to remember, voting is just part of democracy. Activism between elections is a critical part of democracy. It's more critical today than it's been for, I don't want to say it's the most critical time ever. This is a critical time for activism. And activism is patriotism. I am so sick and tired of the idea that these militaristic people are the patriots. And the people sitting on this panel, who are an essential part of civil society and standing up for Americans and trying to do the right thing and who are activists, that's patriotism. You guys are patriots. That is the essence of American civil society. And that is the hope we have from here on out as these people push, 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 and attack. That kind of activism that the people up here represent and the people out there represent and the people listening and watching.
With a sense of what we're facing articulated by our panelists, Rashad Robinson, I want to ask you, as someone who's run successful campaigns, movements around anti-black violence and voter suppression, fighting against voter suppression, what you've done a lot of thinking about the types of leadership and the types of campaigns that are necessary right now. So tell us, what is needed in those areas?
So, not going to be able to do that quickly, but I'm going to give you my sound bites. And then you can, like, you know, visit our website for our longer dissertation. But what I will say is a couple of things. First, I think that we have to recognize that resistance is a strategy and a tactic, but what we actually need to be thinking about is building an opposition movement. Because opposition movements are framed to win. Resistance movements lose all around the world consistently, and opposition movements are preparing to govern. And the couple of things that I think are going to be necessary inside of an incredibly strong opposition movement is, first, we've got to get very clear about the percentages of what people's actions, behaviors, and resources are. And you know, 5% or less in this current regime of mediators. The idea that we're going to be sending a lot of people to doing mediation with this current administration, I think it's been proven to be a fallacy, and we've got to get out of that. 60 to 70% of us have to be working from a fighter's framework. And what I mean by a fighter's framework is that I mean that not giving an inch, not asking the administration for anything, not asking the administration to be less racist, not asking the administration to suddenly care about public education, because that is not strategic in any shape and form. What we have to be doing is holding the set of enablers accountable to create the desertions and corrupt and elevate the corruption that we know is going to happen. Corporate enablers that will play around with this administration on one hand and then talk about diversity in the other. Democrats having a backbone and a spine in this moment and being held accountable the way that Republicans held their folks accountable back in 08. And then holding Republicans who talk out of both sides of their mouth about America and tradition, holding them accountable as well. But if we are not holding enablers in the media and corporations and in government accountable, we won't actually be able to build the type of fighter framework necessary. The final piece is that 30%, which I think is most important, and that's the winners. And on the left, we oftentimes think about that as winning an argument. And I want to say that that's not what I'm talking about. I mean winning real victories for people that actually change their lives. And in a state like California, you are one of the few places right now in the country where that can actually happen. The type of policies that make a difference, where in 4 years or in 2 years, we can say to voters, well, you may not actually like us on the left, but while this was happening at the national level, we were doing things to make your life better. We so often try to have a rhetorical argument with people, and we spend our time trying to argue the facts instead of operating from an action space. And I'll just end by talking a little bit about sort of why that's important given this election, because we have a brand problem on the left. Donald Trump ran a big budget Hollywood movie, you know, like the movie where like the plot twist happened, the bombs happened, you know, a lot of it was fake, you know, it couldn't have really happened, you know, like the president at the end of the movie wouldn't have been able to actually beat up the terrorist. But
I love that movie.
Yes.
By the way.
Yeah. But you walk out probably wanting to see it again. We ran on the left the documentary. And the problem with the documentary is not that the documentary is a problem. I love documentaries. But the problem is that if one fact or two facts are off in the documentary, people throw out the whole thing. So the genre requires that it to be right down to the core. And so if the documentary says I'm standing up for the little guy, but I've given a lot of speeches on Wall Street, it doesn't actually jive. And so people, while they'll forgive the plot twist and the big budget action Hollywood movie, they won't forgive the factual errors in the documentary. And so that is not, so the path forward is not about accepting a whole lot of paint by number pollsters packets and during decide what the right words are. It's about us having a new set of actions on the left. So our politicians not telling people that they care about working folks, but actually our politicians showing up to having Thanksgiving dinner with Walmart workers or giving back campaign contributions from corporations that are polluting our environment or stealing from our schools. It requires us to not just stand up for people to create empathy, but standing up for people in ways that actually move legislation and policy. And so in this, we have to be thinking about what it takes to fight, what it takes to win and what it takes to build a true opposition movement. And that's going to make us uncomfortable in ways. But people are taking to the streets in ways that they've never had before. The folks on the streets that I have been talking to and meeting don't know what organizing means. They have never shown up to a rally before. They want something very clear to do. They don't just want a 10-point policy plan. They want a movement vision. And that's the opportunity in this moment. But it's an opportunity we will waste if we play by the old playbook.
And the thing that people want to do is connect and build alliances around those things. This is actually a question from someone in the audience that reminds me of something that you've talked about, Larissa Dugan-Quadra, which is, you know, really about how this has been a great opportunity to try to build new alliances. You're seeing people come to Caresen and saying, we need to work together. And this question is, how do we reorganize the various communities in the U.S. to effectively resist fascism, which is how this person defined it. But how do we reorganize communities that may not have worked together before? And how are you doing that right now?
Well, we're welcoming anybody who walks through our doors who wants to roll up their sleeves and get to the work. Again, for Caresen and for our movement, the immigrant rights movement, this is a continuation. We have not yet achieved the change that we've been seeking. We've had many wins, particularly in San Francisco and California. And those wins didn't come without organizing, without rolling up our sleeves, without building alliances across communities. We need sisterhood, we need brotherhood, and we cannot work in isolation if we don't break down these silos. And I think the backlash of Donald Trump has been that those silos are kind of automatically disappearing. You saw at the Women's March, it was beautiful because you had the immigrant rights with their banners. You had the women's rights with their banners. You know, like everybody's issues that we all care about, everybody was standing up for that. And we came together. I think the challenge moving forward is how we're going to set, what is going to be that common vision? Is the vision to just resist, or is the vision to transform and to build a society that we're far from achieving? This country, if anybody thinks racism in this country started the day Donald Trump took the podium, or if anybody thinks that oppression against immigrants and working in poor families in this country started with Donald Trump, then, you know, you had something else come to you. And he's just basically kind of lifted the veil on that which we've always known, working class, poor communities of color. And so in terms of transformation, in terms of moving forward, I think we are going to have to all kind of, you know, you have a good sample of issues that we all care about on this panel, and we're going to have to find that common ground and in a way that nobody's demands or priorities compete with each other. This is not about Black Lives Matters is more important than immigrant rights or women's rights. It's about how do we lift all boats. And I think we're going to have some hard conversations ahead. And I think we also need to recognize that, you know, the Bay Area, we're very kind of Bay Area-centric, and we kind of preach to the choir. And we like to speak with people who share our beliefs and who we find welcoming, because that's always comfortable. But I think that in order to, immigrant rights movement, we've had to have very uncomfortable conversations with lots of different people to humanize our struggle. Separating families is not okay. Having children go to school with fear for their parents is not okay. We have to recognize that this, like the history that you just very well, like just kind of summarized, like we are a continuation of the civil rights movement. We're a continuation of all the movements that like the women's rights movement, that all these things have been ongoing. They haven't stopped. And I think we need to engage the youth, because that's how we're going to preserve the long-term struggle in the work. But again, I think we're going to have to ask ourselves some hard questions, and we're going to have to come together with people that we haven't necessarily collaborated before with. But I also want to speak to the idea of polarization. Like, again, we're in this comfortable Bay Area where generally we share the same values, and that's been evident. And by the way, it's not just the Bay Area. I think we saw across the world that so many people in the world share the same values of humanity. We saw that everywhere. I mean, like, they had the smallest march of the Women's March. I can't remember where it was, somewhere in Alaska, I think, or British Columbia. But the point is that we actually have so many values that we share in common. Mm-hmm. And we can't let one person or his club, his entourage, cast a shadow on all the progress that we've made in this nation and all the wins that we've fought so hard for. And we also have to reach out to the other side. And those are going to be the hardest conversations.
Well, Larisa, you raised so many interesting points, and I just want to make sure, you know, you talk about, I hear two things. One is that in some ways the left needs to come together and shore up, right, their energy and activities. Because the Women's March, while very successful, also raised issues. Like, you had people say, where were all these women during Black Lives Matter? Where are all these women during other movements? And can we come together? Will they show up the next time there is a police killing or something like that, right? But then there's also this question of, well, is the time now, though, then to think about national unity? Should we be trying to build bridges? And Tom Steyer, one of the things that you've done, there was an article in the LA Times the other day that talked about how you are expanding your message, right? Expanding your efforts beyond climate change, that you are crowdsourcing in a way and trying to get at the issues, asking people to tell you the issues that they care about. Who's invited to that conversation, one? And two, how are you going to manage all those different things that come to you, right? And
so let me say this. We're all focused on Donald Trump. But the Republicans also control 52 seats in the Senate. Yep. They control, I think, 34 or 35 governorships. They have more than 20 more seats in the Congress than us. They control more state legislators than us by a lot. So it's not just Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. What Rashad was talking about in terms of brand, I see as a deep issue for progressives around the country. And I definitely believe that we have to show who we are in a much more visceral and straightforward way. So when I just listed off all the places where we're at a huge disadvantage structurally to what I would think of the forces of repression, what do we have going for us? What we have going for us is direct democracy. You know, people used to laugh at California for our propositions. You know, everybody thought we were so nuts. Like, who does legislation by proposition? Only the crazy people in California do that. Well, here we go. What do we have going for us? The ability to reach Americans and ask them to act on something. So if you think about where we can win and where we can build this movement, it's at the grassroots. So that's two things I want to talk about, voice and actual face-to-face. Last year, we registered over 1 million people. We had 10 million conversations at the door on substantive things, which was basically environmental justice, racial justice, economic justice in schools, and we're on 370 college campuses. We have to have grassroots people in the community talking to each other, not just 2 weeks before the election, to engage and empower citizens, people in the United States, to know what, to be informed and to care and to know the implications. If that doesn't happen, we really are in trouble.
And forgive me, Tom, sorry, I just want to say that relates to a couple of questions here that I want to give voice to, which is, how do these movements connect with moderates and conservatives and break through the tired old right versus left battles? And how do we talk to off-duty military and law enforcement to see how they foresee their roles in the administration and any other possible aggressive tactics which may come, which I think these are getting at, bridging those differences.
So let me give you 2 points on this. One is about everybody wants to know what to do. Everyone who talks to me says, I'm totally upset. What can I do? And the answer is, you can respond. You know, if you think about when we've had successes in the last 2 weeks, the first thing the congressional Republicans wanted to do was get rid of the Ethics Oversight Office. And Americans said, no way, that's terrible. And the next day, boom, no ethics, they didn't do it. Trump said, we're going to put a 20% tariff on everything from Mexico to pay for the wall. And people said, that is the worst idea we've ever heard. That's terrible. Boom. I was just thinking about it. I'm not really doing it. What we have an ability to do today because of technology is this is our moment. if Americans are not engaged, if we're not, it's not two-way, if we're not coming together and calling Congress people and saying, no, that is terrible, we lose. That is what we have. We have the power to be organized and to respond real time. So the question is, should we be getting our base together, telling people who agree with us, who think the people in this room are sensible, patriotic, thoughtful, people who want to have a brighter view of the future? Or should we be doing the thing that the press is saying, which is we need to broaden our base and go to the forgotten America, working people who feel like they've been forgotten, and they have been. Let's be clear. Working people in the United States haven't had a raise for 30 or 40 years. Their share of American income has done nothing but go down very substantially. The owners of businesses have creamed 100% since at least 1980. So the question is, how do we do that? And my answer on that is, that's who we are. That's who we are. If we aren't speaking to those people, then are we really speaking for our deepest values? Rashad was saying about, do we have a brand? But it isn't, I would use a different language because, and I think Rashad would say this too, it's much deeper than a brand. Mm-hmm. It's who we are. And we need to express that. And if we do that right, it's not a question of who we're going to. Everybody can see where our heart is. And that is actually what we need, is to make it clear, to show what our deepest values is, where our heart is, and that, you know, we're backs to the wall. If we aren't willing to stand up now, then when are we going to stand up?
You were also raising, I think, earlier, the point about people running for office or people trying to get involved at the local level, right? I heard one comment was that after these marches where everybody's thinking big, now it's time to think small. And what they meant by small was to think locally about what you can do. And one of those things was, of course, talking about running for office and recognizing, right, the extent to which that there's very large representation of Republicans across the country in state houses and, you know, in cities and in other communities, and that that can translate into their ability to then continue to draw more and more favorable districts to them as time goes on. So the fight gets a lot harder. One of the things that happened shortly after Trump was elected was that you had considered a run for governor. You were considering a run for governor. And then you said something that was interesting, which was that that you're not sure that that's where your energies are best spent. And so I guess my question is, where are you right now with that?
I said was, and I think it was actually someone from KQED who asked me the question. He said, did it change your mind what happened on November 8 in thinking about the future? And I said, well, of course it did. Something momentous changed in the United States. And we have this gigantic attack on our most fundamental fabric of civil society. And so we need to think as our organization, and me personally, to make sure that we're responding as directly and forcefully to that and effectively to that attack as possible. So did I rethink how we were going to do that? Definitely. You know, we were on 370 college campuses, we probably figured we're not going to do that anymore. Now we think we need to be on more college campuses. Wow. We thought we knocked on 10 million doors with 100 community groups. We thought, well, you know, we did that. Now in the Clinton administration, we probably won't have to do that. Now we think we need to do that more. That's outside California. In California, we felt like we registered over, with 30 partners, we registered over 800,000 Californians last year. We'll show you the numbers when we have full transparency, but we think, because there are 3,000 water boards in California, we can't get into 3,000 races for water board. What we can do is change who participates in everything. And that's what we're talking about. So the answer to Mina's question is, what I want to do, whatever I do personally, has got to be part of this straightforward attempt to get grassroots American informed, energized, and participating, because that's our hope. And anything I do will be to make that effort stronger, broader, and more impactful. And because I feel like that's, if we get that, then we can, you know, my wife likes to say, from the trough we rise.
I want to...
We better.
I want to remind folks that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're discussing civil rights in an uncivil time with activists and change makers. Our panelists are Tom Steyer, founder and president of Next Gen Climate, Abdi Soltani, executive director of the ACLU of Northern California, Rashad Robinson, executive director of Color of Change, and Larissa Dugan Cuadra, executive director of CARES in San Francisco. I'm Mina Kim of KQED Public Radio and also your moderator. And we have a question about what is the role of philanthropy in advancing civil rights. And I want this to go to you, Abdi, because one of the things that, of course, was made very clear over the weekend was that, in many headlines, was that the ACLU got more than $24 million in donations. And, of course...
Did you guys notice that Abdi has a new suit on?
That's true. I did buy it. The last suit that I bought was in 2004. And so I thought after the election, maybe it's time to wear a new suit. So it is true. It is true.
And this was, of course, after ACLU attorneys brought the suit that successfully that was successful in New York in stopping a portion of Donald Trump's order.
Whoa.
So the power of resources, Abdi Soltani, for the ACLU, and I think that plays into the philanthropy question as well, the power of people doing their activism through their pocketbooks.
So first of all, let me just say how grateful I am for the hundreds of thousands of people in this wonderful, beautiful America who are stepping up in so many different ways to affirm our humanity, that are looking at their neighbors as human beings, and as Tom said, you know, affording them the protection of being a human being. And that's showing up in so many ways. It's showing up when people protest at the airport. It's showing up when people are marching in the streets. It shows up when someone has the courage to say, I will be a plaintiff in a lawsuit against this administration when I'm not even sure how well we're going to respect the rule of law. It shows up in so many different ways. One of those ways is in making financial contributions. After the tragedy of September 11th and the terrorist attack on American soil that killed so many Americans as well as the citizens of a number of other countries, there were a set of policies that the Bush administration with Cheney, Ashcroft, Rumsfeld set into motion that really took away basic rights. During that period, the ACLU's membership doubled over about four years. Since the election, the ACLU's membership doubled in just about 2 months. And this past weekend, we saw another surge of support. But I'm going to turn my attention to someone in the audience, Candace. Candace, did the blog post get posted yet? Okay. So this afternoon, I worked and finished a blog post with my esteemed colleague here, Candace, who's our director of communications. And the headline was, "Thank you for your support. Let's go out and build a movement." And I appreciate the support of the ACLU. But what I want everyone to know is that there are so many vibrant leaders in wonderful, dynamic organizations, often led by the people most impacted by the harms to civil liberties. Families of people who are incarcerated or people who are formerly incarcerated themselves, immigrants, transgender folks, people with disabilities. And those groups may not have the visibility right now that the ACLU has. And you know, the ACLU, it's a 100-year-old organization. It's been in the news. People know to turn to us. But I really want to encourage people to support organizations like ACLU, but also do some work, do some research, learn about some of those groups that are led by the communities most impacted, and lend some of your support there as well. And stick with those groups. Stick with them, because they're going to need your support through thick and thin.
This is an audience question that I want to ask, and any of you who feel like you have an answer to this can chime in. Why do you believe protests and people movements can influence this president and this administration? Trump claims that he speaks for the people. Larissa Dugan-Quadra.
Well, one, it lets the president know that the American people are not going to just stand by and watch. But I also think, I heard through the radio, you know, like all the people were detained at the airport. One of the things I kept hearing was, in the middle of this traumatic experience, one of the things that gave them hope was that there were people at the airports protesting. Mm-hmm. And the protest is not just to let Donald Trump know that we are not in support of him and his clans, you know, kind of run over the people and just do whatever you want, but it also sends a message to other nations across the globe. And I think we haven't talked about the fact that, you know, you mentioned Mexico, right? And I am so glad Peña Nieto said, okay, fine, we'll cancel the meeting. Take your power. But, you know, there's nations all across the world, like, at the edge of their seats. Economies are, we're in a global state. This isn't just this island over here. You know, the United States has I lived in a war in Nicaragua that was financed by the U.S. And that's the reason why many of our families migrated to the United States seeking safety, and that's still the case. We have continuously had to migrate because of wars and because of economics. We've been forced to migrate. And I remember when I was a kid saying, why didn't the American people stop this? Like when I would go to a funeral, to a friend's funeral who had fought in the war and who died, who was killed by U.S. paid weapons, I asked, why do American people let this happen? And then I had the fortune of coming to San Francisco in 86 to visit my dad. And we went to Lens Crafters. And when we came onto Market Street, there was a huge protest in solidarity for Nicaragua. And I was like, yes, okay, then the American people do care. Because when you're far away, you don't know that what's happening. You know, the news don't always, we didn't have the internet back then in the 80s. And so I'll never forget that day. I'll never forget that day because I realized that there were lots of Americans that cared and that were protesting and that were donating and that were actually going down to Nicaragua and to Central America. Tessa went down there in the 80s to help, to put themselves in the line too, to say, we're not going to allow you to murder priests and we're not going to allow you to just murder children in villages because of global power. So there's a whole other element here too to the notion of, you know, Donald Trump may think we're ridiculous, but it creates pressure. And it also fuels those who want to resist, not only in the United States, but across the globe, that we're in this together. And again, the Women's March was a perfect example. I think there's a lot of what's next. And I do believe that we all need to work from our place of strength. And as long as we can unite those strengths and kind of tap into them and leverage them, there's room for everybody's talents and everybody's resources and time to make this happen. And it has to be broad. It has to be consistent. We can't let this become the new norm. And so it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And we're going to need the resources. We're going to need people to do the relay. So somebody, a mother, can go take care of her child or of her family, and somebody's going to have to step in. So we just keep this thing going, and we're going to have to be careful with our time and resources so we can be in it for the long haul.
Tom, that's okay.
I would just give one example of what's very current right now, which has to do with the nominations for the cabinet. And one of the nominations that is hotly contested, of course, is for Secretary of Education. And two Republican senators today, who coincidentally happen to be women, came out and said that they were not going to support the nominee. And they said there have been lines at our congressional office at home, which is Alaska and Maine, opposing the candidate. And they're listening to their constituents. So what I would say, the reason I said that asking people to do things and to take action is so powerful is because the strongest power in the United States is the will of the American people. And every single official has to listen to that will. And those two senators they weren't breaking party ranks for the heck of it. They weren't doing it because they have a deep-seated policy issue. They were doing it because their constituents said, we care a ton about this. And that's a huge power that we have to go to.
And this speaks to your point, Rashad, about it may not necessarily be going directly to Trump himself, but going to the enablers, to the people that you may be able to influence.
Absolutely. And over the course of the next 4 years, I think we're going to have to be a lot more creative and strategic about the levers that we pull and how we build power. One of the frameworks that we have at Color of Change is not to mistake presence for power, not mistake awareness, people paying attention, an op-ed getting printed, a retweet from a celebrity, not mistaking that for being able to have true power. And power is the ability to change the rules. Sometimes the unwritten rules, sometimes the written rules. Over the course of the last several years, Color of Change and our allies have been showing up in these moments where police officers have not been held accountable locally, or have shown up where we've wanted more transparency from district attorneys about the rise of mass incarceration in this country. And we weren't getting the results that we wanted. And this election cycle, Color of Change launched a PAC. We engaged our members. We picked 7 races. We learned from and watched the Bernie Sanders campaign in terms of peer-to-peer text messaging and bought access to black folks' cell phones. We matched those with the voter files. We engaged our members and talked about the power of district attorneys. And we got over 3,000 of our members to volunteer on weekends after weekends, texting into district attorney races that they didn't actually live in to communicate with voters about those DA races. Over 1.8 million voter contacts were made around district attorneys. 85% of district attorneys run unopposed in this country. 95% are white. This is not like a hotly contested race in most places around the country. So people were not just showing up to engage in their DA race, but in DA races where they didn't actually live. 5 of the 7 races we won, we got 3 black women elected district attorneys. Black women represent less than 1% of district attorneys nationwide. 1.8 million voter contacts were made in from Color of Change, and then we partnered with local organizations to make even more. People before the election were willing to engage and take action when you could make the case that it meant something in their lives and it could have a fundamental change. People are willing to do even more now, but we have to make the clear and strategic ask. We have to ask people to do the things that will actually make a difference in their lives and explain it, and people will join us in that struggle and in that effort. The district attorneys will be even more powerful over the course of the next several years, and being sort of the stopgap around immigration, around questions around will women be prosecuted for having an abortion, all sorts of deep questions that actually have nothing to do with what we traditionally think of as sort of criminal justice. And if we are not thinking about all the levers that we have to pull both nationally and locally, we're not going to build the progress. But the good thing that we can all be hopeful about is that people are ready. And the question will be, will we be ready to give them the things that they need to do?
This question from the audience is the current chaos meant to cause a distraction from something? For example, Trump's Putin connection. How can we refocus? And I think this is a really interesting question because that's been brought up, right? Is the reaction, is this all, you know, expected? Are they just sort of testing the waters? You know, what are they? Are there other more sinister things going on behind this? And this is all just meant to distract us. And it kind of gets into what will probably be my last question as well, is how do you deal with all of that that's coming, right, all at once? And then to be able to focus and understand the levers that you need to pull, as you say, Rashad Robinson, and just how do you stay charged? I think there are concerns about a fatigue factor already, right, after just the first 2 weeks.
Well, I'll just maybe jump in real quick. I would say, first of all, we do have a tremendous number of tools. This Constitution, this country, it's a couple centuries old. This is the oldest republic on the face of planet Earth. And those principles are dearly held by people across the political spectrum. And the Tea Party folks and the ACLU folks, the Color of Change folks and the NRA folks, this is too precious for all of us to just roll over for one change of administration. And so I think to that point, it's really important for us to be working in each and every state with people of all political parties and not write anyone off, while at the same time energizing and mobilizing our own base. In the last election, Rashad talked about the work on prosecutors, and we're so proud to partner together in that work. Let me take you to Oklahoma. Oklahoma is a very, very red state. And Oklahoma has, I believe, the second highest rate of incarceration. And the ACLU was able to partner with a number of Oklahoma-based leaders, and our ACLU of Oklahoma led the charge, to pass criminal justice reforms almost identical to what California voters passed just a couple of years ago. So I think that we have to just use every tool that's available to us, from the Freedom of Information Act to litigation to protests to investigative reporting, and have all of that just roll forward. And we have to sustain it every day. And there's not a day where we'll be able to lower our guard. And maybe there's a day where one of us individually has to step back, as I did a couple days after the inauguration. I took a few days off. But there are other people who step forward so I could take that break, and then I'm back full charge. So that's my take, is let's use every tool at our disposal. Let's use them vigorously and not expect that the same rules of the game apply, but let's use every tool at our disposal.
Tom Steyer, it looks like you have something you want to say. I'm seeing you write down your answer there.
I think that there's a big temptation now in attacking Mr. Trump personally. And I think that he's done a lot of things that are personally offensive, and a lot of them have been brought up, and I'm sure that there are many more that we're going to find out in the weeks and months to come. But I actually think that that's a mistake. I think the way that we should think about this is a little more strategically than that, and it's basically two things. What are the things that we're trying to protect where he is attacking the interests and rights of Americans that are fundamental to us? And we can never let that go unnoticed, because he doesn't win because we agree with him. He wins if we let him do it and are passive and acquiesce to his wishes. So I'd say strategically we have to focus on his actual actions and how they harm Americans and our better vision. We have to, we have a better, more optimistic, cleaner, more just, more inclusive view of how America should work. And we can never get away from that. We have to play our game and stand up for the things that we deeply believe and never move away from that and not just be anti what he's for. We're for a bunch of things that are better for Americans. But the truth is, I'm with Abdi every single day. There's no chance. This is not like, one of the things I figured out was, it's not like a job where you go home at 5 on Friday and it's like, woohoo. The fact of the matter is, we're in this in a constant fight to push forward for the view of America that I believe is common in California, that is much more just, that to me is the patriotic view that Americans have worked for centuries, that is very broad-based, that it goes across gender, across ethnicity, across income level. And if we do that and push that view consistently all the time, we will win.
What I feel like I'm hearing from this panel is that opposition to Donald Trump cannot be the unifier. We kind of saw the folly of that in the Hillary Clinton campaign, right? That you actually have to put out a compelling vision and message. You're beginning to articulate it, Tom Steyer, but I also feel like what I'm hearing as that message is we can't go back. And I think that's powerful, right? If people face the prospect of losing what they feel like they've already had, is that enough, Rashad Robinson, as the vision? If you had to articulate it, how would you?
I think we will lose a lot. And I think if we don't have a positive vision, that's laddering up our fight as we're losing and laddering up the standing up that we're going to be doing for communities, then we are going to have a bunch of individual battles that we lose, and we won't have the narrative, the brand, the community connection that will actually move us forward. I agree that we don't want to attack Donald Trump personally, but I do think that we have to articulate the plot against this country that is happening Absolutely. Right now, and the plot against the values of this country. And the fact of the matter is that there is a plot and there is a collusion between Donald Trump wanting to make as much money off our government and put his name on everything, and at the same time a right-wing Republican base that's never liked what this room looks like, that's never liked the progress, that's never liked the freedoms that so many people have been able to get. And the deal is that if they work together, they will somehow swallow the things that they don't like about each other to get things forward. And so the Never Trumpers are now on board with voting for, and if we don't do more than just say that he's breaking his promises, because politicians of all political parties break their promises. If we don't do more than sort of really walk people through how this country, not just the politics of the right and left, not just that we don't agree politically with his cabinet choices, but that there is fundamentally something different about this, then we will maybe win some elections here and there, but we won't take back our country. And we won't get the people on board, because people could come to hate Donald Trump and not choose us in return. People could build a resistance to Donald Trump between poor white folks and black folks, and that could look very like anti-immigrant in some parts of this country. And so we have to not just thread the connections that we make at the top and at the leadership levels, but through our communities in deep and authentic ways, and tell a story about America that all of us can find ourselves in. And hopefully we'll, when we do take back this country, we will govern in a different way than we've governed in the past.
Well, I want to end on this audience point. This person writes, not a question but an answer to the question of what can I do. Every person should be joining an organization that can channel collective action. It is not sustainable to be doing resistance on your own. Join an organization. I want to thank our panelists, Larissa Dugan-Quadra, Executive Director of CARES and SF, Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of Color of Change, Abdi Sultani, Executive Director of the ACLU of Northern California, and Tom Steyer, Founder and President of NextGen Climate. This program has been sponsored by the San Francisco Foundation and is part of the Foundation's series focused on people, place, and power in the Bay Area. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Mina Kim, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.